Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is once again time for what I think for many of you is your favorite podcast of the week. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein you never know what we're going to talk about, which is part of the fun because we may be addressing precisely a problem that afflicts you or a loved one. It is an opportunity for you to send your questions directly to us. Our Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mudin, and I will attempt to answer them. And the way to get questions to us is via radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com. And how are you doing this week, Layla?
I'm all right. How are you, Dr. Hoffman?
Very good, very good. So you got a winter strategy in place to keep healthy?
Yes, I'm looking forward to spring. That's my strategy.
That's your strategy. Okay. Well, do you do anything special? Do you eat a certain way, or do you exercise, take certain special supplements, or are you tanning, anything like that?
I'm not tanning. I haven't been tanning. I've been taking my vitamin D, however.
Okay.
My supplement, my diet doesn't change much from season to season, except for eating more seasonal produce, you know.
Okay.
That type of thing. But no, it doesn't really change that much. You know, I'll change my vitamin D dose depending on what my serum levels tell me, for instance.
What about your exercise, maybe a little less on the outside, more exercise inside?
More exercise inside, which is typical for me anyway, so the weather really doesn't matter.
Doesn't affect you? Sure.
It's more on the inside.
What's your favorite exercise?
My thing, I'll do yoga and I do strength training primarily.
Okay.
And you have the
weights and equipment in your apartment or do you go to it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I use more, body weight, but I do have some, some dumbbells and stuff like that. And I do a whole lot of squats and lunges and things and
planks and things like that.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My strategy is, I love running outside, but it's a little daunting. I don't know. I guess I'm a little less inclined to run when it's, wind chill factor of -2. So I'm in the pool a little more lately. I run on the treadmill inside. If we catch a warm day, like we've been having a few warm days, we'll take a run outside. And spin classes instead of being on the bike, because the problem with being on the bike, it can be cold outside. Maybe it's not that cold. Maybe it's only, freezing, 32 degrees. But when you get on the bike, you're going 15, 20 miles an hour, and you've got a built-in windshield factor. It's a lot colder.
That's true. Now, do you cover your mouth when you do that out in the cold weather?
There are some cyclists who have these balaclavas, their whole face is covered. They have these head coverings. They have footsie coverings. They have, I actually have lobster kind of gloves that are really good for cold weather temperatures. But, I guess I have a little bit less intrepid these days about going out in the cold. The spin classes are fine for me, 45 minutes of sometimes an hour high intensity spinning will do the trick. So, this is kind of a blah time of year. I use the wake up lights in the morning, the morning lights. And those kind of get me, because it's kind of dark and gloomy when I get up at 6 in the morning. And you want to get a little light in your eyes to stimulate you. So,
That's true.
So we're fending off the winter blahs. And although we see, quite a lot of sick patients, mostly, fending off some of the little nuisance kind of infections. And I'm doing the Whole 30 this month, and I've been reporting on it to our listeners. I wrote an article about it.
Yeah, how's that all going?
It's going fine. It's going really well. I feel I'm mostly not aware of cravings. It's more like I'll go for hours and hours and hours, and then I'll say, yeah, I'm really hungry. And so instead of having, sometimes breakfast might be leftover salmon on a gluten-free bagel, I just have a leftover salmon. Yeah, maybe with I need maybe some carbs, so I'll have half a sweet potato or something like that. This morning I had an interesting thing. I made for the first time, I have a source of natural turkey, ground turkey, and I made turkey hash with sweet potatoes. So it was kind of a mix of sweet potatoes, put some
delicious.
I salted it up, put some sage in it, and then I fried a couple of eggs and put the eggs over the hash. I actually put a picture of that up on Facebook. So that was a very satisfying breakfast. I didn't need anything else. You know, I didn't need bread or, you know, the whole idea is to sort of avoid bread, avoid sweets,
avoid that
kind of after the meal feeling that, oh, you know, I got to have dessert now.
Yes. And you know, it's so many people feel that way. Well, now I have to go have a cookie
right.
or something. Yeah.
Right. Got to have it. I mean, and it's a pretty strong urge. And about, you know, I would say about day 10, 11, 12, that feeling was abolished on this Whole30 diet.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. And my energy is good. My clarity is good. There's no alcohol in this either. And I don't think I'm particularly bent out of shape by alcohol. I tolerate it pretty well in small amounts that I consume. But I think I even feel clearer without having that in my system. So, I'll write a recap of it when I reach day 30 in a couple of weeks for our newsletter. So,
looking forward to it.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm going to tackle this week. I might tackle the juicing controversy. So, what our take is on juicing, which is, we're not that big a fan of juicing, right? You and I?
Right.
Yeah.
I am always going to prefer, and I've been saying this since the beginning of juicing, since it all began, that you're going to be more satisfied when you chew, when you masticate,
yes.
when you chew your food.
Careful your language.
This is,
this is a family. This is a family podcast here, Layla, so your words like...
Yeah.
Okay. Masticate.
So, instead of pre-digesting it in the blender or in
right.
the juicer.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the basic idea. Although, people have the sense that they're just getting these power-packed nutrients from the juice. Or alternatively, there's a sub-controversy within this. Is do you juice or do you blenderize? You know, we have the Nutribullet. We have as opposed to the Champion Juicer, there's the wet blenders, these powerful blenders.
Right. So it's a matter of is the fiber in or is it the fiber out?
Yeah. So we'll weigh in on that subject, I think, probably in a week or so. all right. So let's get directly to questions. What have we got this week?
Okay. We've got a question from Michael. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Does vitamin C require insulin, like glucose, to enter the cells of the tissues? No, I would think not. And here's something I'm reminded in Gary Taubes' book, where he talks about, I think it was in Calories In, Calories Out, how glucose, our blood sugar, and vitamin C are actually antagonistic.
They compete for the same receptors?
Exactly.
Okay.
So if glucose obviously needs insulin, I doubt that vitamin C does, and I think our best example of that is the vitamin C drips.
Right.
That's not requiring insulin. But let me go on with this question here.
Sure.
Can one actually control the amount of sugar metabolism by taking high oral doses of vitamin C while taking in some foods containing higher levels of sugar as well? My answer to that is actually no.
Yeah.
Because I think the amount of sugar and carbs in your diet is more going to antagonize the vitamin C and keep the vitamin C from doing its job than the other way around.
Right.
Taking more vitamin C is not going to counteract that.
Yeah, I think that speaks to what is called the anti-nutrient effect of sugar, which is that sugar, by its presence, may engender higher requirements for certain nutrients, particularly, I haven't thought so much about vitamin C, but particularly the B vitamins, B because to get that sugar metabolized requires the cofactors in the Krebs cycle, which always demand more B vitamins. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know about the vitamin C connection. But.
Yeah. And the other part of Michael's question is, does vitamin C act as a substitute food for glucose for cancer cells, or is vitamin C toxic to cancer cells even at lower levels?
Oh, I think it's the latter.
Yeah,
I don't think that in any way, shape, or form, there's a. I don't really think there's a pathway from ascorbate to glucose. We can look it up and look in a biochemistry text, but I just don't think that any way. I mean, you can actually get you can get protein to ultimately release glucose. There's a
yes. You know,
there's
the amino acids can break down and
gluconeogenesis. It's called you know, where you take certain amino acids, the gluconeogenic amino acids that are part of proteins. These are which are those like glycine, I think certain of them. They're gluconeogenic, and then your body can actually take pure protein. If you have no sugar, you can actually why is
you can overdo protein. You can have no sugar, but on a low carb, high fat diet, you can also overdo protein, and that will become blood sugar, that excess protein.
But here's the thing: even let's say you're on a metabolic ward, and they feed you just fat and protein. 100%. There's no cheating. There's no way around it. And then they check your blood sugar. They will find that you have a blood sugar that's probably lower than if you were eating sugar, but it still will be maintained, you know, homeostatically by the body between 60 and 80.
Yes.
And that's because the body produces sugar, has to produce sugar. Either it produces sugar from fat stores or it produces sugar from dietary sources. So, you know, when you say we're going to starve cancer cells, for example, well, you can't really, because you can't get to zero blood sugar.
Right, right. You know? And we would die on zero blood sugar anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. So it's, anyway. So that's
vitamin C is antagonistic with glucose.
Okay.
So the more carbs and sugars we're eating, the less vitamin C we will likely absorb. So this is actually a very important point, and it reminds me of Gary Taubes' book. I believe it was Calories In, Calories Out, that particular book where he goes into that, which was fascinating, and that it's absolutely toxic to cancer cells, vitamin C, and that's why, you know, the IV drips are,
but only
helpful.
Pretty much only at high doses. It really requires the very high doses to get that killing effect, and that's why just oral vitamin C, you can't get there with oral vitamin C. You can do a lot of good with oral vitamin C. But in terms of a specific cancer killing effect, it's not going to happen.
Right, right. And we can only tolerate maybe just a few grams of oral vitamin C. I believe the upper tolerable limit is about 2,000 milligrams. Some people can take as much as 5 or 6 milligrams without getting diarrhea, but the intravenous is as much as 25 grams to 75 grams, isn't it?
Even 100. Even 100. Yeah, even we have 100. A couple of patients taking 110. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Michael, thanks for that very interesting question.
He's one of our wonky listeners, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
A little biochemistry there.
Right. Kelly has a question. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I love listening to your programs. I appreciate your continued health advice. I'm a 23-year-old female, and I'm attempting to regain my menstrual cycle after it stopped at the age of 16. It only lasted for about a year, and I suspect I had a higher body fat percentage at this time. Kelly says, I exercise 6 days a week, 45 minutes of running or swimming daily, and 3 days a week, an additional 25 minutes of strength training. I'm 5'4" tall, and I intentionally gained 10 pounds 5 months ago by increasing calories. My workout routine, however, has remained the same. In an attempt to regain my cycle. So now I weigh 110 pounds at 5'4". However, my menstrual cycle is still not concerned. I'm concerned about my bone health and getting a regular cycle again. I'm not sure what else I need to change. And honestly, I would like to go back to 100 pounds. What are your recommendations? Now,
well,
Kelly, at 100 pounds at 5'4", was already at about a BMI of about just over 17, which is clearly underweight.
And I think there's actually statistically they show that under a BMI of, say, 18 or 19, it dramatically increases the likelihood that you're going to have menstrual failure.
Yeah. And now at 5'4 and 110, she's just under 19, her BMI, and that could still be why.
Right. And sometimes it's not even just the BMI, it's just the high activity level. And it's actually, it is possible for women who are thin to continuously menstruate, but once you don't have a normal start to your menstrual history, sometimes things get stuck. And it's sometimes hard to rekindle that. You actually may completely lose your ability to restart your cycles, like no matter how much weight you gain. So it's a tricky kind of problem. I think one of the ways to address this, I mean, certainly she's got to cut back on the exercise. I mean, if she really wants to do the experiment, you know, she has to prioritize, you know, what's more important, normal menstruation, which is not just about, you know, using Kotex once a month. It's also about the refreshing effect that it has on the body, the bone-enhancing effect, the overall benefits of having a normal complement of female hormones as God and nature intended.
Yeah.
You know, so these situations tend to be tough because we don't even know precisely what she eats either. Now, she's focusing on weight, but maybe she's, you know, eating a diet where there's insufficient fat or protein. We don't know how she got there. So it could also not just be the overall calories and the impact on her weight. It could be some deficiency of a macronutrient category, you know, fat or protein, or it
could
be...
And even with her 10-pound weight gain, she just still might not have enough body fat to support the hormones.
Right.
As well, so, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I mean, I appreciate a warrior exerciser like she is, but maybe some of...
This is called FAT, Female Athletic Triad. It was very common, and women often sacrifice their periods on the altar of athletic achievement.
Yeah. I mean, you see that a lot in gymnasts, well, Olympiads, but that's a different matter.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So... Kelly, what is our recommendation to Kelly? You know, you should get a workup by a doctor or a nutritionally oriented practitioner to see what you're eating, how you can, if it's a matter of weight gain, gaining it reasonably, maybe tapering your exercise or having an exercise program that's better suited to your having normal menstrual cycle.
Mm-hmm. And another way to sometimes jumpstart menstrual cycles is to work with a traditional Chinese acupuncturist with sometimes the accompaniment of certain herbs that may help to naturally restart the periods. I find that that could be helpful.
Yeah. Kelly, best of luck to you. Thank you for your question. Okay. We've got an email from Terry, and Terry sends us a link. Dr. Hoffman, please take a look at this link about Ostanol. Is this fact or fiction? Now, I was reading this article. I think Dr. Hoffman, I'm not sure you got to take a look at it.
I did. I did see it because, and I've seen it before in relationship to, maybe it was in relation to this question or to another, and somebody said, hey, you know, I looked at a website and it rated Ostanol, and Ostanol didn't really come up very highly recommended on this website. But, you know, why don't you share what your impressions are?
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all, it's sponsored content, okay? And the title is Ostanol Reviewed, Does Ostanol Work? And the claims they're making in the article, let me quote, the manufacturer alleges that this product has undergone 20 years of clinical studies, 40 years of research, but says there's no further content provided to back up its alleges. That's actually incorrect. I've been to the Zycal Bioceuticals website, and there are many, many, many citations there. So it's a matter of, you know, you go to those research studies and you look at them yourself.
Right.
But the information is there.
Yeah, and I've met with the developers of that product, and while I'm not at liberty, they want me to be a little reserved in sharing to the public some of the results of their studies, which are positive. But I just for the sake of, you know, it's work in progress, they have some very good research that is underway that suggests that it really does work. And I think it's something that's worth taking for people who are concerned about bone. But moreover, the research that they're also working on suggests that there may be an anti-inflammatory property to that in conditions like osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, and maybe even, you know, extending to other inflammatory disorders. So, you know, while the word isn't quite out on it, it's a relatively new supplement. It's not fair to characterize it as not effective or making outlandish claims. They're very earnest. They're spending money on research, which is commendable because, you know, a lot of companies just put it out there and it's like, okay, you know, we'll get an interview on Oz or something like that, and after that, we'll sell billions. But yeah, I think that there really is something there.
Yeah.
It's a supplement that I actually take on a regular basis because I'm concerned about protecting my joints. And while I don't have a fracture and I'm not particularly concerned about osteoporosis, I think it's a good supplement.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I wouldn't place much clout on this particular...
And then also, when you say it's sponsored, you know, I looked at it and I said, you know, you always have to consider the source. And I think the problem with the general public is they're very intelligent and sophisticated, and they know now how to get on the internet and Google things and find things. But then you have to also consider the source. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet that is thinly veiled propaganda that, in this case, I suspect that that review was completed by somebody who has a stake in denigrating Ostanol, because what they're trying to promote is a different product. And sometimes it's very subtle. You know, there's like a little link on the website to another product sales site where you can get what they rate highly. You know, so, there's a little bit of sleight of hand going on there.
Yeah, yeah. So, Terry, we hope that answers your question, and I would take Ostanol.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a question from Larry. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I was perusing a vitamin catalog, and sometimes it's confusing. I take alpha-lipoic acid as part of my blood sugar support system. Is there any difference between alpha-lipoic acid and R-lipoic acid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's ALA, alpha-lipoic acid, and there's RLA, R-lipoic acid. And this is a controversy that's been brewing for a few years, as much as 8 or 10 years, as to which is more efficacious. R-lipoic acid is thought to be more specific. It is more expensive. Technically, what they're referring to, the R stands for right. And so they're what are called enantiomers of different compounds, which are either right-sided or left-sided, or a combination of right and left-sided. And the alpha-lipoic acid, I think, is a combination of right and left-sided, and the R is just the specific R fraction. Now, it's argued that the R is what the body needs. The body doesn't need the L, and therefore, when you have a mixed product, mixed enantiomer, that the L might interfere with the R, and it's not as effective. However, there's plenty of research looking at just old-fashioned alpha-lipoic acid without the R-lipoic acid, and it works pretty well. So I'm going to say that this is in the realm of controversy still, and we don't know the ultimate answer. And it may be a tempest in a teapot, and or it may, you know, ultimately prove that one or the other is more effective. And then, you know, there's also a cost concern because R-lipoic acid is fancier, more expensive. And there is a tendency in the industry to take something that is good and modify it. So an example of that is DHEA. DHEA is very popular, but now every company can make DHEA. But if you want like a competitive advantage, you make something like keto DHEA, right?
Oh, you've yeah.
heard of mm-hmm. keto DHEA, mm-hmm. which is thought to be the claim is it's safer, it's more effective, none of the downsides of DHEA. But I'm not entirely sure that that's true because there's so little research on keto DHEA. There's a lot of research on DHEA, but keto DHEA is a variant on it where it's thought to be more efficacious, certainly going to allow a company to charge more for it. But then the question is this a superior product? And then, you know, we can sort of slice and dice. And this is how you kind of separate yourself from the crowd by developing a modified product. Maybe your curcumin has a little bit of black pepper in it. You know, the black pepper you claim makes the curcumin more bioavailable, so all the other curcumins are a waste of time. Or you encapsulate your products in capsules that don't contain stearic acid, which is another claim is that this is bad, which we already have debunked.
Magnesium stearate, yes.
Right. Magnesium stearate. So, you know, that's kind of the way this industry goes, and we have to kind of separate the fanciful claims and fads from the real facts. And this is, don't you think, it's a hard job, isn't it, Layla? I mean, we're constantly,
we're spending a lot of time.
I think for every hour, really, I think, especially you, for every hour you spend with patients, you probably spend about 3 hours researching stuff. You know, so that you know what the latest and greatest is. And I know that my ratio is probably comparable to that, so that we have the answers to precisely these little niggly questions.
Right. Larry, thank you very much for that interesting question.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is about all the time that we have for part one of today's Q&A with Layla. And so what we'll do is we'll advise our listeners to go to part two. And in part two, what are we going to expect to hear about?
Oh, okay. Is putting honey in my yogurt going to kill the probiotics?
Oh, okay. Interesting question. Well, honey we know is a disinfectant.
Antibacterial.
So let's tackle that question when we return. Part two of today's Weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.